people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for not, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, December 5th, 2012. Report shows that Israel have killed four Palestinians after the truce, and President Abbas to go to UN resolution against Israeli settlements. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in the Gaza Strip reported that 191 Palestinians, including children, women and elderly, have been killed by Israeli military fire in Gaza in November, and that the number of injured Palestinians in the same month stands at 1,492. The Health Information Center of the Ministry reported on Wednesday that 48 children, including 16 under the age of 5, have been killed by the Israeli missiles and shells, in addition to 12 women and 20 elderly. The center added that 1,492 Palestinians, including 533 children and 254 women and 103 elderly, have been injured by Israeli fire and shells. Furthermore, four Palestinians have been killed after the ceasefire agreement was reached and 54 have been injured. Internally, Osama Hamdan, head of the International Relations Department of the Hamas movement, stated Wednesday that Hamas will be heading to Cairo this month to participate in meeting meant to implementing the Palestinian Unity and Reconciliation Agreement, and warned Israel against continuing its violations of the ceasefire in Gaza. Hamdan added that there are talks and efforts meant at holding a meeting very soon in Cairo, adding that he expects that the meeting will be likely taking place in the coming few days in Cairo. Elsewhere, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, headed by President Mahmoud Abbas, decided to head to the United Nations Security Council to ask it for a resolution ordering Israel to stop all of its settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and in occupied East Jerusalem as well, especially the recently approved plan to build more than 3,000 units for Jewish settlers. On Tuesday at night, the PA held a meeting headed by Abbas and decided that it will stand firm in opposing Israel's new settlement construction plan, adding that the future of the two-state solution and the entire peace process is threatened by Israel's illegal settlement activities and its ongoing violations. Last week, Israel announced the new plan to build some 3,000 settlement units in the West Bank and Jerusalem in response to UN General Assembly vote that granted Palestinians a non-member state. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, December 5th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bandoura.
One week after a ceasefire ended the recent cross-border violence between Israel and Hamas in Gaza on November 21st, the Palestinian Authority followed through on their long-standing plan to seek non-member observer state status in the United Nations General Assembly. The November 29th vote in favor of a new status for Palestine was overwhelming, with 138 in favor, 9 opposed, and 41 abstentions. Although the U.S. and Israel had strongly opposed the move, European nations such as France, Italy, Spain, Norway, Denmark, and Switzerland all voted yes, while Britain and Germany abstained. Among the benefits of Palestine's new status is their eligibility to join international bodies such as the International Criminal Court, where they could file charges against Israeli settlement building in the West Bank or the military assaults on the West Bank and Gaza. In response to the UN vote, Israel seized more than $120 million in tax revenue they collect for the Palestinian Authority. The Israeli government also announced plans to expand Jewish settlements in the West Bank by building 3,000 more housing units. More alarming was the order by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to move ahead on plans to develop an area known as E1 east of Jerusalem that, if built, would effectively cut the West Bank in half. Britain, France, Spain, Sweden, and Denmark summoned the Israeli ambassadors to their countries to protest the settlement expansion. Your reporter spoke with John Quigley, professor of international and comparative law at Ohio State University. He assesses the significance of the recent UN General Assembly vote upgrading Palestine's status and the prospects for restarting long-stalled peace negotiations.
On one side, you have the statement that was made by the United States ambassador following the vote on Thursday in the General Assembly, where she said that the resolution does not mean that Palestine is actually a state. So, I mean, you have that point of view, which I think would be shared by Israel and maybe two other states in the world, that the resolution does not actually regard Palestine as a state. That is, of course, completely in contradiction to the text of it that refers to Palestine as a state. However, for the government of Palestine, it involves a continuing, you might say, higher level of acceptance of it as a state, which is going to make it easier for Palestine to participate in international organizations in a variety of ways that will assist the people of Palestine. There are quite a few treaties that could be entered into by Palestine that might enhance its position in a rather practical way. One is the Law of the Sea Convention that deals with such things as control over ocean space for fishing, which of course has been an important bone of contention off the Gaza coast, and as well to undersea minerals, which could potentially be important in preserving Palestine's rights to the natural gas deposits that are off the shore of Gaza. There's also an international treaty on civil air transport that acknowledges a state's control over airspace and has procedures to protect that. And that, of course, is an issue because of the flights by Israeli aircraft over Palestine territory, including the drones like the ones that were over Gaza during the recent attack there. But more generally, I think Palestine can operate more effectively at the international level, being considered a state. The next step, of course, would be to membership in the UN, which would enhance its position even farther.
Professor Quigley, the Israelis promised retaliation, and they did, after this vote, withhold $120 million in tax revenue from the Palestinian Authority, but maybe more importantly, they vowed to build 3,000 more housing units in contested areas of both East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And there's also plans afoot to develop land in a very controversial spot that would divide the West Bank in half. What can you tell us about the price that the Palestinians will be paying given this threat of Israeli retaliation here?
Well, it's unclear exactly how that threat will be carried out. Israel has come in for some very severe criticism in the last 24 hours over this. The European governments, interestingly, are getting into the act and calling in the Israeli ambassadors in their capitals and making it clear that Europe is not prepared to put up with this. And Europe has quite a bit of leverage because of the trade relations between Israel and Europe, leverage that potentially could be used by Europe. But the threat to initiate this major new settlement development east of Jerusalem, you know, is potentially a very serious matter, and it would, in effect, make it impossible to get from the southern part of the West Bank to the northern part of the West Bank for Palestinians. I mean, it's already very difficult, but this would make it much more difficult. But it highlights, again, the importance of what Palestine may be able to do as a state, because once the International Criminal Court prosecutor decides that the court has jurisdiction over crimes committed in Palestine, one of the crimes that it could investigate would be the establishment of settlement.
Well, just a final question for you, Professor Quigley. It's widely believed across the world that Israel won't bend in any future negotiations with the Palestinians off the hard line it's taken of recent years without United States pressure. And now that the U.S. election has passed, do you think the Obama administration has any possibility of applying pressure to Israel to be a fair broker for future peace negotiations that could succeed after so many decades of failure?
Well, that's a $64,000 question, I suppose. The history on this has not been good. U.S. administrations haven't been inclined to divert. Both political parties think they have to be very solicitous of Israel in order to retain power in the United States, so that even in a second term, the Obama administration is going to be concerned about the next election and whatever Democrat runs. And there are, of course, elections for Congress again in 2 years. So that's the negative side. The positive side is that you did have President Obama at the beginning of his first term seemingly opening up to the Arab world with his speech in Cairo in 2009. And for a time, that raised the popularity of the United States quite dramatically in the region. So he has some sort of precedent, you might say, for having taken action that moves in the opposite direction.
That was John Quigley, professor of international and comparative law at Ohio State University. He is the author of The Statehood of Palestine. For more analysis and commentary on the drive for Palestinian statehood, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, 6th of December. Two American soldiers from North Dakota were killed in an insurgent attack and one was wounded. Afghanistan reported 6th of December. Witnesses reported that British troops deliberately shot and killed four Afghan boys at point-blank range during a so-called counterinsurgency operation. The victims have been named as Fazl Mohammed, 18, Naik Mohammed, 16, Mohammed Tayyab, 14, and Ahmed Shah, 12. British Defense Secretary Philip Hammond is being asked to open a formal investigation. Pakistan, 5th of December. Two Pakistani soldiers were killed by a double suicide car bomb outside the Zarai Noor camp in Wana, South Waziristan. Soldiers ordered the cars to stop outside the base gate, then the bombs were detonated. Pakistan, 5th of December. A Pakistani army soldier was killed by cross-border fire from Afghanistan. Unknown if the Afghan army or the Taliban was responsible. Mr. Barack Obama, this war is going nowhere. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops and all of the drones home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
Welfare reform, let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. Rich pigs and birds, children and rags. Welfare reform, let them be kicked. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too.
On the 1st of December, Earthquaker Action Team carried out a national day of action against PNC Bank, either the number one or number two investor in mountaintop removal coal mining. 15 branches of PNC Bank were hit by protests, including the one here in D.C. at DuPont Circle, which was closed for 2 hours because of a nonviolent protest by Quakers and Climate First. When an advanced team of four, two with PNC accounts and checkbooks, approached the bank, they intended to enter and demand to speak with the branch manager. They found all doors of the bank locked 5 hours before their normal Saturday closing time.
They're already scared. I was talking to an old lady and they're scared.
Doors locked.
Have you got your checkbook or something?
Their account holder.
No account holder was let in during that 2 hours. Not even an unrelated customer who ended up banging on the window demanding to be let in. This was because of PNC Bank's investments in mountaintop removal coal mining.
And I am here today to work for Appalachia. I can't live in Appalachia because I live around here. But I can still try to help Appalachia people and get rid of mountaintop removal mining. It's an absolute disgrace to be polluting our water. The stuff that comes out of the ground in Appalachia, the coal, we burn it here. I see it every week going by on the freight train when I'm going to work. The freight train goes by with Appalachian coal in it, and we burn it here. So we are in part responsible for polluting groundwater in Appalachia.
PNC Bank, this is just the beginning. Many groups are mobilizing to shut down mountaintop removal coal mining, and Patriot Coal has just thrown in the towel and shut down their big mountaintop removal mine. Your investments in this form of coal mining are going to lose more and more value, and other groups might come to the homes of your executives to protest. Now's the time to do the right thing and dump mountaintop removal investments before they dump any more poison into water. And if you're listening to this and you have an account in PNC Bank, you just might want to move your money and dump your ties to mountaintop removal. On the 3rd of December, two activists against the southern leg of the Keystone XL tar sands oil pipeline in Texas locked themselves to 600-pound concrete barrels inside a section of the pipeline. The blockade shut down work for the day on the Keystone XL, and in the process of forcibly removing them from the pipe, the police pulled so hard on the 600-pound barrels that the chain connecting one of the activists' wrists to a barrel broke. Both of the activists locked to the barrels and a support person also inside the pipe were arrested and, get this, held on $65,000 bail each. Not only is this bail outrageous, but according to the Texas Penal Code, no one can be held on a bail of more than $5,000 per misdemeanor charge. Here's an interview released as a video on YouTube with the activists recorded inside the pipe the night before while they were locked down inside.
My name is Matthew Almonte. I'm here from Tampa, Florida, and I'm here in Texas blockading the Keystone XL pipeline.
I am.
Okay. So, it's the first night being here in this pipe. Basically, we've set up shop here.
I feel it's very important for people to feel empowered to take action against resource extraction. The Keystone XL pipeline is, it doesn't really serve to benefit anybody but the corporations who will reap all the profit at the expense of the communities that will be poisoned through their water, through their air, and it's just not right. And I wanted to plant myself in the middle of that fight against resource extraction, because I feel it's all really tied together, whether it's here in Texas against tar sands, or in West Virginia against coal extraction, or in Pennsylvania against fracking. It's about coming together and making a stand against those who are trying to exert their influence, their power, their corporate criminality over the rest of us. And I feel like this campaign is filled with people from all walks of life, whether they're students or they're workers, their parents, everybody that I've met here is dedicated to fighting this struggle because it is one of the most important struggles that we face today. And that's why I'm here, dedicated to staying in this pipe as long as it takes to make the point that Keystone XL Pipeline has no place on this planet.
You are so right about that. A top NASA or NOAA climate scientist, not sure which agency, has said that if all the oil locked in the Alberta tar sands is burned, at the price of having to use five times the BTUs in fracked gas as the BTU value of the oil in order to extract it, it's, quote, game over for the climate. First for communities in the path of the Keystone XL, then for all of the rest of us, and yes, even the oil barons themselves, tar sands oil is just another way to die.
In mid-November, more than 100 activists gathered at an historically black church in Boston's South End for the New England 350.org Convergence to share stories about organizing successes and to discuss the next steps in fighting climate change after the U.S. election. Sherry Feutlin, who lives in South Central Louisiana, was one of the speakers at a morning roundtable. She's a small-town journalist, blogger, and mother of six children. Her husband works on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. After the BP Gulf oil disaster in the spring of 2011, Feutlin walked more than 1,200 miles from New Orleans to Washington, D.C. to demand government action to stop the massive BP Gulf oil spill. In October, as part of the tar sands blockade protest campaign, Foytlin chained herself to a gate of a Texas pipeyard, part of TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline project, and was charged with criminal trespass. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus, who was at the 350.org Boston gathering and heard Foytlin speak about her activism, later caught up with her by phone at her home in Rain, Louisiana. Here, Foytlin describes her journey to becoming an environmental justice activist and her arrests in several states protesting fossil fuel extraction and climate change, both of which disproportionately impact communities like hers near the Gulf of Mexico.
I'm a journalist for a small-town paper, and I went out on a tour that was guided by BP, but I felt like I didn't get the real story, so I went back the next week and jumped on a boat with a fishing family and was really moved by what I saw as real consequences, tangible consequences, devastating consequences to the communities along the Gulf Coast who I love and the area that I love and the ecosystem that I adore. And I really take a hard look at myself and realize what I was contributing to that. And I don't just mean that my husband, you know, working in the oil industry, it's a strange paradigm here, but we have very few choices. You know, we've become so dependent on the industry itself. So part of my work has been to try to bring in green energy options here and try to change the social currency that's here that keeps us so reliant on an industry that is so determined to basically kill us. They don't care about us. They don't care about our oil workers. They don't care about our families. They don't care about our ecosystems.
Cherie Foytlin, when you spoke in Boston in mid-November, two other workers had just been killed on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. How common an occurrence is that?
You are not going to get a study anywhere out of the oil industry itself. It's responsible for reporting its releases, and it's also responsible for reporting any injuries. Very often, the oil workers themselves are punished in the way that you do have stop work authority, but you can be blackballed for using that authority. We have no unions here. There's no protection here for the oil worker. There's very few protections for the whistleblower. So that's pretty much what happened on the Deepwater Horizon, in that some of the men, even the men that were killed, had said that day even to their loved ones back home that they thought that they were going to die on that rig. They knew something was wrong. They tried to get help. They called into Houston and were denied a voice, let alone protection of their body, because honestly, for the oil companies, it's cheaper to pay for a funeral than it is to set up engineering and safety restrictions that would protect these workers out here on the rigs and on land. That's part of the dilemma that we face.
You mentioned trying to bring green alternatives to your community. What does that look like in your town?
In Lafayette, Louisiana, the Sierra Club and myself and others are working really hard. We actually have two coal power plants here. We're trying very hard by 2014 to get us off of those coal power plants and to bring in energy alternatives. But also an important aspect of that is I would really like to see a co-op kind of agreement so that we can provide the educational and health opportunities that we need here and work industry opportunities here and also community agreements so that the oil workers are able to divest themselves from the fossil fuel industry and go work with something that's going to provide a sustainable future for our children.
I know you've been arrested several times protesting various fossil fuel projects, you know, basically around the country. How did you, as the mother of six and the wife of an oil worker, come to that decision to be arrested?
I was trying to look for anything that would work, and I read a lot about the civil rights movement of the 1960s. I read the letters from Dr. King when he was sitting in the Birmingham jail, and he said that when negotiations fail and there's nothing left, that the only thing we have to turn to is nonviolent direct action. So last year, I was arrested in front of the BP office trying to return the tar balls to them that continue to litter our beach and probably will for the next 30 years, and was arrested at that time for refusing to leave. Not too long after that, I was up in D.C. for the protesting the Keystone XL pipeline, thanks to 350.org and the climate justice movement, which also has had devastating effects on our communities. We have had six major hurricanes in the last 7 years and are still dealing with Katrina, Rita, Isaac to this day. And unfortunately, the southern leg of that pipeline is coming down through Oklahoma and Texas and threatening our Houston environmental justice communities as well as our Port Arthur, which is one of our most devastated environmental justice communities in the Gulf of Mexico. And so I was arrested there. I think it's been about 2 months ago. But honestly, it's not about the arrest as it is the fact that people in the Gulf of Mexico have no voice, and this is what we are left to do. And if myself, being a mother of six, have to take one for the home team and get arrested now and lose my freedom for as long as they decide to keep me, in order to protect my children so that they have clean air and water and a livelihood that doesn't take their life away, then I'll gladly give myself up. I think any mother would.
That was environmental justice activist Sherry Foytlin, author of Spill It, The Truth About the Deepwater Oil Rig Explosion. Find links to Foytlin's articles and more information on climate change activism on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.